Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report that autism rates in among children jumped by 15% between 2012 and 2014, continuing a two-decade increase. Today, we're talking about why the apparent increase and treatment and education for people who fall along the autism spectrum. Independent health and science journalist Karen Weintraub was among the first to report on the recent CDC's findings. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Mark Tassé. He's director of the Ohio State University Neisonger Center. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you.
Karen, tell us a little bit more about what the CDC reported. It went from, looks like, 1 in 59 to 1 in, I'm sorry, from 1 in 68 to 1 in 59. Is that considered a big jump? Was it expected?
It was expected, and so the CDC counts in 11 communities every 2 years, so they've been consistently doing this for about 20 years now. So they're not entirely representative. We can't say that 1 in 59 of every, and they count 8-year-old children, we can't say that 1 in 59 of every 8-year-old across America has autism, but this is basically as good as we can get in terms of numbers. So somewhere between 1 and 3% of children are considered to have autism at this point, which is a substantial increase from 20 years ago.
But as Karen Weintraub said, Mark Tassé, it's not unexpected. Why?
Well, it's not unexpected because we are refining our ability to identify children with autism. We've had a campaign for the last decade of educating family members to learn the signs and identify early the signs in their children. We've worked with pediatricians on establishing early screening during wellness checks at 18 and 24 months. And another change I think that we've seen in this most recent prevalence study is that we're closing the gap between white children and children of black or Hispanic, black race and Hispanic ethnicity. Now that gap is closing.
Karen, why does the CDC track this but not explain it?
So all they do is keep numbers. Mm-hmm. They don't look at the cause, and their numbers can't reveal the cause. They're looking in 8-year-olds. They're not looking in newborns. So there's really no way to use this data to figure out why this is happening, other than, as Mark just said, that we can see now in the last few reports that more kids from minority backgrounds are being diagnosed. And the people I talk to say that's a great thing because minority kids aren't being left behind as much as they were before. Being diagnosed means becoming eligible for services. So it's a difficult diagnosis. Not everybody, it takes some pushing on the part of parents. There may have been some prejudice in some cases where people thought, oh, this kid just can't hack it, not mm-hmm. this kid has a problem we need to treat.
Mm-hmm. And a stigma maybe among minority communities?
It's possible. Usually stigma is inversely related to services. If they can get services to help their kid, then there's less of a stigma involved. But yes, certainly mm-hmm. there is some concern about stigma.
Yeah, it's true. And I agree with Karen. And, you know, what we've seen is that with black children and Hispanic children, the ones who have higher IQs tend to be missed more. So we're not identifying the children with autism who have IQs in the average or above average range, which is a lot of the children that we've increased in our identification in the last decade. There was a time where children with autism, about 75% of them, had co-occurring intellectual disability. Mm-hmm. In this most recent prevalence study from the CDC, we're now down to about 30-31%.
So more high-functioning people.
Exactly.
And what about the diagnosis among adults? Is that increasing at all? Is that a piece of this?
So that's, you know, as was mentioned, as Karen mentioned, this study specifically looks at 8-year-olds, school-age children.
Right.
So
yeah.
we know that these children all grow up to become adults with autism. And mm-hmm. that is a concern, is that in the adult service delivery, employment support, post-secondary, we're not doing as much as we should do in providing services and supports for those adults as much as we are with children. And that's an area of great need.
You know, Karen Weintraub, this feels sort of like a census that we're taking to figure out what services are going to be needed in the future.
Exactly. And there's never been a census of adults, as you were just saying, Mark, that we really don't have any idea what the numbers would be in adults. There was only one study ever done well in England, and they found that 1% of adults in the UK had met the criteria for autism. But we really don't know what that number would be in the U.S.
And they're expecting a further increase, Karen Weintraub?
They are, because minorities still haven't caught up to white kids, because there is a wide variation. This study, for instance, showed almost 3% of 8-year-olds in New Jersey were diagnosed with autism, while the number was closer to 1% in Arkansas, which is the lowest rate. Now, it's not clear if that was because the New Jersey kids, there are a lot more services in New Jersey. It's a more urban population. There's a connection between older parents and autism. So maybe, you know, the parents are more urban, more able to get diagnoses in New Jersey, more doctors and who do those diagnoses in New Jersey than in Arkansas. It's not clear if Arkansas is going to go all the way up to 3%, but certainly there's room still for increases. And New Jersey is still increasing. And that's something that we can't explain.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about autism this hour in the wake of the most recent report by the Centers for Disease Control that, once again, the rate of autism among children is increasing, has increased in the United States and is expected to. Mark Tassé?
Yeah, what's interesting about New Jersey is that there is a range in across the 11 regions that are surveyed or participate in the CDC study. And what's interesting is New Jersey was the only site where there was no racial disparities, where black children, Hispanic children, and white children were identified at comparable rates. And that's not true in the other sites where we see a larger disparity in identification.
Does that larger disparity correlate largely with the comparison between New Jersey and Arkansas, that more rural states or sparsely populated?
Yeah, so it's not clear, you know, whether it's only race and ethnicity, but there's also seems to be an interplay with socioeconomic status and such things.
So the poorer states like Alabama, Louisiana, Mississippi, that kind of a thing, you're going to see more disparities.
Correct.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The term Asperger's syndrome has been dropped in favor of a broader reference to the spectrum. Karen Weintraub, is there any significance in that?
That happened a couple of years ago,
right,
when the new Bible for psychiatric conditions was released. It's significant for a couple of reasons. I think some people wanted to identify themselves as having Asperger's because it's generally considered more mild. But also, you know, it is a spectrum, and sometimes no two people have autism in the same way. And so I think that's why they went to this spectrum as opposed to breaking people off in a way that didn't really make any medical sense. Also, in recent months, we've learned that the man for whom Asperger's was named did some very was not a wonderful human being.
Well, he did research on children for Nazis.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he was part of the Nazi Party, and so there's a sense that we don't want to be remembering him today.
Yeah. So the CDC's report, some say that it's just catching up, that their data is just catching up with reality. What effect does that have on the kind of job you do at Ohio State, Mark Tassé?
Well, you know, the CDC report is important because it reminds us that we are not identifying everyone who has autism. And what happens also is the CDC report shows us that the median age at which children are being identified is about 4.5 years old, which is way too late. It's too late for early intervention, early services, where we know we can bend a curve on the core features. So the CDC report reminds us that we still have a lot of progress to make in terms of early identification of the children with autism so that we can intervene early and improve their quality of life.
What obstacles are there right now to identifying them at a younger age?
So, you know, I think we need to do a better job. You know, there's a big campaign through CDC in educating the public on what are the signs, what are the early signs of infants, you know, as young as one, one and a half. But we also need to do a better job of supporting pediatricians and making sure that when parents bring their baby to the pediatrician for a wellness check, that they're screening for autism, because that's the touch point.
How do you screen for autism with a one-year-old?
So there's a lot of there's a series of questions. There's a standardized set of questions that a pediatrician has that they can ask. Things like, does the baby orient to noise? When you call them, do they turn their head? Do they look? Do they engage? Try and engage the mom or their environment in their play? Is there like interaction or reciprocity in some of their engagement? So there's a lot of simple questions, and there's a lot of research that's been done where we can actually look at birthday videos of a one-year-old and identify already early markers in those infants who later are identified as having autism. So we can identify it young.
But Karen Weitraub, the CDC is going to stick with that eight-year-old measurement?
For the moment, yes. There's some pressure to lower it, but if you lower it, you tend to miss the people who have been missed in the past, the minority kids and girls, who both tend to be diagnosed on the later end. And so lowering it might increase those misses. The one thing for what Mark was just saying, there is a lot of research going on and some significant advances coming in terms of developing a diagnostic marker for autism. There's some things like eye tracking. There are other biologic things in the blood that people are starting to find that can identify autism at an very early age, would be really significant.
If there are biologics that can be used as markers, is that...
There has not been to date, but that's what they're working on, right?
Working.
Some objective marker to say, yes, this child has autism at 3 months, at 6 months, at 9 months, at, you know, a year, and start that child in some kind of therapy at that point when it would be the most effective.
And would the identification of a biological marker, would that mark an advent of finding, for lack of a better word, a treatment or a cure?
I think that's not the aim right now.
Okay.
But it's more for early diagnostics than it is for finding a treatment. There's not... there's no, at this point, no uniform cause of autism, no obvious this in the blood means the child is missing that. It's so diverse. But one of the things is autism may be many different conditions, not one. And so a marker might help us figure out some of that diversity and understand, you know, the way we used to talk about cancer as one disease, and now we know it's hundreds. Maybe autism is a number of different conditions wrapped into one.
Fragile X syndrome is supposed to be the only known cause of autism?
There are a few genetic causes that account for about, I think, 5 or 10% of kids on the spectrum.
Does that help with trying to figure out the other 90%?
It does. Researchers often pick sort of genetic causes of a condition in order to understand that condition. And so there's been a lot of research into the genetic. Rett syndrome is another one. There are a couple of other single gene mutations that can lead to conditions, to symptoms that we call autism. Again, it's not clear whether autism is one thing or a number of different things.
Karen Weitraub, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Karen Weitraub is an independent health and science journalist, educator, and author of the book, The Autism Revolution, Whole Body Strategies for Making Life All It Can Be. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about the news, about the it's not surprising, but confirms what the experts believe is going to be a continuing trend of increase among the people that are diagnosed with autism. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the Centers for Disease Control report that autism rates among children increased by 15% between 2012 and 2014. That means overall, the rate has climbed 150% since the year 2000. We're going to talk about treatment and the future for these children. Joining us is the director of the Ohio State Neisonger Center, works to improve the lives of people with neurodevelopmental disorders, Dr. Mark Tassé. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And director for the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. Jackie Nguyen. Welcome.
Thank you.
And clinical psychologist and director of Amigo Family Counseling, a private mental health center in Columbus, Dr. Emilio Amigo. Welcome back.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Dr. Amigo, does the reported increase surprise you from where you sit?
Yes and no. It doesn't surprise me from the standpoint that from our clinical work, you know, we're seeing in particular a broader range of ethnicities being represented. We've been seeing more females coming in, and that the report kind of really indicated that. I think also the report also suggests that the way we diagnose and the way we understand autism can make a difference in terms of, you know, prevalence rates and incidence and so forth. And I believe that we're refining our approach diagnostically. We're being more specific as to what we're looking for and how we understand it. And I think that would affect the numbers to some degree as well.
Why are females being missed, or have they been missed in the past?
Well, I think some of the research we have on the diagnostic criteria could be skewed a little bit toward the boys.
So like lot of stuff is.
Yeah. I think just like other medical research, we have a bit to catch up on to really represent girls in the diagnostic features. But the thoughts are that there's a little less overt symptomatology. So it's less clear. They're a little quieter, or their repetitive behaviors are more internalized. And so they're just getting missed for longer periods of time. And, you know, in general, we have to work harder across all realms to listen to the symptoms of women and girls, you know, the physicians and us as clinicians. We need to be listening a little bit better. So I think we're working harder to do a better job.
Because the symptoms present differently, Dr. Tassé, does it mean the treatment's different too for women or for girls?
Not typically. I think typically we provide, I mean, obviously the treatment will always be personalized or individualized, but we'll, as a group, we don't necessarily have women treatment or men treatment for people with autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about autism this hour in light of the latest report from the Centers for Disease Control that the rate of autism among children in the United States increased by 15%, 150% since the year 2000. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. With us, Mark Tassé, he's director of the Ohio State University Neisonger Center. Also, Dr. Emilio Amigo, he's a clinical psychologist and director of the Amigo Family Counseling. It was featured in a documentary a few years ago on PBS. And Dr. Jackie Nguyen, director for the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Donnie in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Donnie.
Is it me?
Yes, it's you.
It's Donna.
Donna?
Yes.
Okay,
Donna.
Sorry about that. Okay, go ahead, Donna.
Hi there. Yes, hi. I'm the mother of
Donna, let me interrupt you. Your voice keeps going out on your phone. Are you holding it?
Oh, yes. I'm holding it right up. I don't know if my phone's experiencing problems or not, but I have it, you know, on.
Okay, well, we'll try to get your
face.
Question in. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm the mother of a 17-year-old, soon-to-be 18-year-old male with autism. My son has autism. My nephew was diagnosed a few years ago with autism. My concern is that, you know, we're saying things like the cost of treating these people, of caring for people with autism over the course of a lifetime is staggering. I don't believe it's sustainable, you know, as we see the rates increasing. And I wonder, about the people on the panel if they are concerned about that as well, and identifying causes, because I don't believe this is better diagnosis. This is not something that we had in our family before this generation. You know, it's, we certainly love our children and support them as long as we can, but, and not to mention the cost of just treating autism symptoms and early identification and remediation, but outcomes are still poor even with that.
Yeah.
Social employment, all of those outcomes are still poor. And not to mention the comorbid conditions that go with autism, the seizure disorders. I have, you know, older adults who are developing mitochondrial and other mast cell disorder. They're being diagnosed with that new, you know, syndromes that are coming where they
fall apart. Well, let's hear what the folks in the studio have to say. Dr. Jackie Wynn, the cost is staggering. The treatment's very expensive. It's all personalized. That automatically assumes a larger cost.
Yeah, and there's, you know, autism is complicated for kids and adults who are affected more significantly by autism. There's a lot of areas that need to be addressed. You know, it's related to their functioning in everyday life. It's their social emotional needs. It's helping them gain employment. It's helping them through relationships. It's helping them through mental health issues. So there is a lot to do. We know that the early intervention needs to be as intensive as possible. That's expensive. So, I mean, the CDC report is important because it does help us gauge and calibrate how much money, how much emphasis, how many programs that are run by state agencies, federal monies, you know, how much do we need to really tackle this?
Lots of different agencies involved. Does that complicate things? Does that make things more expensive?
Well, I think it's important to work in concert and collaboratively. You know, in addition to agencies, you know, the complexity of autism requires interdisciplinary work, different types of professionals working in concert together.
Everything from dietitians to physicians to therapists to like therapists like Dr. Amigo, that kind of a thing.
Exactly.
Dr. Amigo, you work to help socialize. It's a big thing that you're known for, is to help particularly higher functioning people. How does that work? How did you come to this kind of place where that's what's needed for some people?
Yeah, well, I guess I'm not alone in making this statement, but I've gotten older over the years, and so have my clients. And in addition to being, you know, gainfully employed and developing, you know, job skills and all of the other life skills that we want them to have, they continue to have needs and issues and challenges. And, you know, there's that phrase that 18-year-olds on the spectrum fall off the cliff. A lot of times services are no longer available or they're not as easily supported. And so one thing that we've done that I'm excited about is a collaborative research project with Ohio State University and the City Regional Planning Department, where we were looking at issues related to housing, transportation, recreation. What are the needs of the autism community? And we provided some adult client focus groups. And so we're looking at what do we need today for these individuals. More and more of my caseload are older. They're young adults or middle-aged adults. And I'm afraid we have forgotten them in some regard. So I'm very excited about, you know, spreading the word and continuing to see the needs as very, very important, regardless of age. We need to be, you know, supportive.
It's not something you grow out of.
No. In fact, it can be even more difficult and harder as systems of support let go of you and focus on younger population.
I was trying to figure out yesterday what Medicaid coverage there is in this case. I know it's considered a disability, so Medicaid kicks in, but I wasn't clear. I know it differs between states, right? What states offer. In Ohio, what do you get?
Can I? Yeah, every state can develop their own Medicaid services. So in Ohio, We have a few different things that families with children with autism can access and adult individuals can access. So a lot of it comes through our boards of developmental disability. So if the person is considered eligible for those services, i.e. having a disability, then they can go on a wait list for a waiver, a Medicaid waiver.
A wait list,
yeah.
Though.
So we
That's
do have
not a,
a
good thing.
Yeah, we have a wait list system in Ohio. There's a certain number of slots, and they're distributed across the state to each county. And there are different kinds of waivers. There's kind of lower cost waivers, maybe $5,000 a year. And then there's other waivers that are much more expensive. But it accesses and is connected to Medicaid, but kind of comes through, instead of an income-based eligibility, it comes through the DD eligibility. And then the person would also, if they got that waiver, would be eligible for all of the Medicaid services. So Medicaid would cover all their medical costs, their speech and OT, their psychology services, that kind of thing.
Jackie, if I could ask a question, in your opinion, what percentage of individuals on the autism spectrum actually receive that type of assistance?
Well, I don't think it's a high percentage, but I don't know the number. I do know that there are often long waits.
Do they compete for slots with people with other disabilities?
Yes, so it's all together. So it's not just an autism waiver. It's within the developmental disabilities.
And a lot of times it's based on need, and level of functioning.
Based on economic need and
or just your adaptive functioning, like the more severe cases might be more readily, eligible for services, and then the others who need the help, but maybe not to that same degree.
Well, I think that's an important point that Dr. Miko makes, because, we have about, probably estimated prevalence in Ohio, we probably have more than 100,000 people with developmental disability based on our population. But our state and county board system can only really support about 35,000. And so there is a prioritization based on level of care. And unfortunately, people with autism spectrum disorder and don't have co-occurring intellectual disability really fall low on the prioritization in terms of level of care. And that's a challenge we have right now, especially with young adults, is providing them with supports and providing them with services when they may not qualify for a developmental disabilities waiver. And some of these services and care can be expensive for the family.
Right.
And I agree. And I would say, too, that the severity of the need is no less if you don't have intellectual deficits. In other words, the other concerns you have are debilitating. And one of the interesting findings of the report is that, and this statement may sound weird, but we're getting smarter. In other words, the level of IQ of individuals diagnosed with autism, 70% is, above 85 IQ and above. Before, we used to think it was automatically below, 85 or in the 70 range. That's only 30%. And there's almost 40% of individuals on the spectrum that are average to above average.
And yet they're less likely
to receive services. But the debilitating effect is just as powerful.
A lot of lost opportunity too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Sure. I mean, the gifts that these kids have, can sometimes be masked by the challenges that they're facing. I say kids because I'm from a children's hospital, but all individuals, they have so much to offer to workplaces and in relationships, but some of those barriers can be hurdles that really prevent them from living as fully as they would be able to. So we need to keep focusing on those supports.
So the data's been behind the curve and is just catching up. And likewise, the support systems and funding for the support systems are way behind the curve then.
And I think Ohio's been trying. I think we're kind of in the middle of the pack in terms of states. So there are some states where if you're identified with a disability, you automatically get wraparound services, in-home supports, coordinated care. And other states don't have really much of anything at all. So, we have autism scholarship program for kids out of Department of Ed. We have these waivers. We have our rehab services focusing on employment first and employment programs to to help individuals become meaningfully employed. We have an interagency work group, which is the leaders of each of these agencies coming together on a periodic basis to try to knock down the barriers in the silos. So I think we're trying, but there's still a long way to go.
I'm thinking 10 or 15 years down the road, where are people going to live? How are they going to be situated? What about when their parents pass? Who's going to take care of them?
That's the work that Ohio State was doing, and it continues to do so, because that has, those questions have to be answered.
In Ohio, we have a mission to have people with disabilities included in our communities. Mm-hmm. And so the days of there being sort of separated facilities for people to live in are really over. So there is a system of supports that help individuals find a home, have supports there maybe even all day long or into the night. So families, as kids transition to adulthood, one of the things families are figuring out is, you know, what should the residential situation be? Where should our child come to live? And they might live in the home, but they also might be moving into the community and getting some of those supports established.
I think that's an important point, is that we really want to advocate for these adults to live in the community as much as possible independently. But there is a movement among many parents of young adults with autism who feel that the system has sort of abandoned them and is not helping their son and daughter. And there's this movement right now that we're seeing across the country and in Ohio of parents coming together and trying to identify planned communities, which is really, in my view, not the ideal solution, because we want people to live as integrated with what everyone calls other people, neurotypical or typical people. But this is a real phenomenon that a lot of parents are concerned of, where their son and daughter are going to live after they pass away.
You know, when I think about that, I'm thinking about kind of like older people who are banding together as well and kind of hiring concierges, mm-hmm. to, you know, so that they have a little more strength in numbers and commonality, common concerns and common challenges.
Yeah, and there are communities like that that are then, so including older folks, but also younger people with disabilities or younger people with other challenges. And
to kind create of, that integration.
Right.
It's almost like an intentional community.
Where
it's very inclusive and it's a seamless lifestyle, but the needs of the individuals are, you know, addressed appropriately. So
work as well. I know there's the company Let Us Work. I've interviewed the founders of that some years ago, and I see their products in the grocery stores now. That idea is to create a continuum of work opportunities, everything from manual type labor to analytics.
Yeah, in the past, we could rely a little bit on sheltered workshops. So very segregated, very contrived work environments for people with disabilities. So the mission has been to get rid of those and to really help companies and businesses figure out what the value of employing somebody with a disability might be. And then there's an additional work of kind of entrepreneurship, where companies are starting with not only a mission to provide a product, but also to employ people with disabilities. So mm-hmm. we're trying to invigorate the workforce and companies to try all different means to put a reaching hand out or to develop a place where people with disabilities can thrive and be meaningfully employed.
And I've got to support that. A lot of my adult clients, I really believe, would make the best employees. They're honest, they're hardworking, they're diligent, they stick to the plan, the job description. And I think they're the best employees, really, if you think about it. They just need to be respected and understood, you know, for their differences.
That's Dr. Emilio Amigo. He's a clinical psychologist and director of Amigo Family Counseling. Also with us, Dr. Mark Tassé. He's director of the Ohio State University Neisonger Center. And Dr. Jackie Quinn. She's director for the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Guess what we're talking about? Autism today, in the wake of the latest report from the CDC that the rate of autism among children in the United States increased 15% from, 1 out of 68 in 2014 to 1 out of 59 children. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about autism in the United States in the wake of a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention that revealed a 15% increase in autism rates among children between 2012 and 2014. That's part of an overall 150% increase since 2000. Still with us, the director of the OSU Neisinger Center, which works to improve the lives of people with neurodevelopmental disorders, Dr. Mark Tassé, also the director of the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Dr. Jackie Nguyen, and clinical psychologist and director of Amigo Family Counseling, a private mental health center in Columbus, Dr. Emilio Amigo. You know, off the air, we started talking about the families, the siblings, the parents, and the stresses that they experience. And Dr. Amigo, I'm sure you see that. That's part of what you do. It has to be.
Right. When you're treating someone with autism, you're not really treating them unless you're considering the whole family, the support providers, the parents, the extended family, the adult siblings. I don't know one family that I've worked with that had brought a young child to me that's not already thinking about what's going to happen to their child when they're no longer here. I mean, 60, 50, 80 years into the future, they're already concerned. And so I think we have a responsibility to equip those family members, educate them, provide them with all of the opportunities to understand how we could have a wraparound approach to helping individuals on the spectrum, housing, you know, again, recreation, employment, all of those things. They have to have that specific, like a team to assist them.
Right, right. And the funding for that?
Well, I think there's a struggle for that too. So families do have insurance lots of times, and there has been advocacy federally to get more coverage for individuals with autism, including the family support. So there are better and better kind of benefits within families' insurance plans. And there, in Ohio, we just passed an autism parity law that clarifies that autism cannot be an exclusion on insurance. Mm-hmm. So in the past, we used to find that almost 50% of families coming to us, along the list of things that were excluded for coverage was autism care, which was just kind of mind-boggling. But now that is not legal in Ohio. And in fact, more services, including intensive services, are covered. So families could potentially access some of that. And I think Medicaid is looking at what do families need for kids with autism that isn't really clarified within our state plan, but could become more beneficial and provide more clear supports for autism if a family has Medicaid benefits.
You know, it's one thing to have a child, a young child with autism. It's another thing to have an 18, 20-year-old, 180-pound man with autism. There's so many socio-psychological changes going on in the best of circumstances in this country. Dr. Amigo, you work on socialization a lot. That's a really big deal. In that documentary that was on PBS a few years ago, talked about a prom sort of thing that you held for them. Tell us what you do.
Well, we have part of our program is a creative social arts program. So we believe in establishing opportunities to be part of a community. So we have a group therapy program. We have a Friday night club program where it's a collection of our group members come together. And then every quarter, we have a big event. And that particular year, we had a huge spring formal where we had almost 100 clients on the spectrum come. And it was like a prom, but it was really an opportunity for those individuals who missed out on their high school prom, couldn't go, weren't invited, weren't welcomed. And one of my big beliefs is that just because you have autism doesn't mean you're excluded from life's milestones and life's privileges and opportunities. And so we have a responsibility to provide those. And as adults, that means relationships, dating, sexual identity understanding, employment. Just the integrity of a human being is sometimes forgotten when we deal with people with disabilities.
You want to lump them all
together.
Which
is completely wrong, completely wrong. They need the opportunity to mess up and to struggle and to have heartbreak and, you know, to be hired and fired and move on. They deserve that. That's what we're about, is giving them every opportunity to be fully human.
And the natural inclination is to protect them from all of that, because who wants to see anyone wants to see their kid go through quote-unquote heartbreak or anything like that, or failure at a job or anything.
A young woman we're working with and a young man, they like each other and they want to go out and date. And they're in their 20s. And one of the parents, when notified of this, said, "We will not allow that. I don't want my child to be heartbroken. I don't want my baby to have a baby, so I don't see them ever dating, ever having a relationship, ever having intimacy." And I thought, wait a minute, we need to rework this. You know, we got to be human first.
Which is a huge thing. I mean, that's a huge change in general about how we consider people with intellectual disabilities, developmental disabilities, that kind of a thing. And that started changing, particularly with people. With Down syndrome, probably 30 or 40 years ago, changing how we socialize. And has that wrought the – or, you know, brought – you know, the, they sowed the seeds 40 years ago. It has brought about the kind of changes that they were hoping for, Dr. Tase?
Well, you know, you know, as they grow up to be adults, it's important to, you know, what Dr. Amigo talks about, sort of give them the dignity of risk, you know, give them the opportunity to try things. And sometimes as a parent, we want to be protective. We want to make sure that they don't get hurt, that they don't they aren't taken advantage of. but really, it's to a lot of credits, a lot of parents really push against that reflex and want to give them, their sons and adult sons and daughters, the opportunity to find a job, have a romantic relationship, date, and yeah, they'll have hardship and they'll have failures, and hopefully they'll have the support to grow from that and learn from that.
And it matters, as they age. I mean, it does make a difference.
Absolutely.
As they grow up.
And I think there's been a beautiful self-advocacy movement within individuals with autism. So, I don't know, maybe 6 years ago or so, I don't know, maybe the others have a better timeline, but I think when Asperger's disorder became much more prevalent and talked about, people with Asperger's syndrome moved forward to have a voice, and so have been self-advocating and talking about their right to be respected, their right to be considered different, not imperfect, and all
that
of these.
It's not inherently a bad thing.
Right, and that it's a difference that they have that they can move through life with and might not want to change. And so they've talked a lot about these issues of adulthood and relationship and helped everybody, I think, shift a bit to work with that in a better way.
And they pushed against a lot of the professionals in the scientific community against this emphasis and almost soul drive and focus to find a cure. And they reminded us that there are a lot of adults with autism, and they don't need to be stamped out or cured. That
or their behaviors changed.
Right.
It's an interesting issue. Pat in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Pat.
Well, I just wondered. I hear a lot of people talking about how they're treating autism. And a lot of programs that I think are wonderful for people with autism. Mm-hmm. But I don't hear anybody talking about what caused it. And I have only to say I'm 88 years old, and I grew up in a neighborhood outside of Pittsburgh. I knew everybody in my class. We all graduated from it. One boy was sent to military school because he was stealing cars and he got in trouble. Mm-hmm. But I can actually say I don't remember anybody that had autism. And nowadays my primary care doctor has a child with autism, and I'm hearing about it all the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, I wonder, I'm sure there's research there. I wonder what's causing it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that's really... We talk about how the data's catching up with what is believed to be something that's much more common. But I get what Pat's saying. Is there a baseline change in the number of people with autism besides just the better diagnoses and that kind of a thing? Dr. Tassé?
I think one issue here at hand is that a lot of those individuals, those children, those adults were there. We just called it something else. We called it intellectual disability. We called it schizoid affective disorder. We called it just being odd or socially aloof.
And they were also put away a lot of times. Back maybe when Pat was in grade school or high school, back then things were very different how they were treated.
There was a special class for students when I was growing up.
Well, there were special hospitals yeah.
You knew they were different. You knew they were odd. You just didn't stop to think that they had a condition. You know,
I knew somebody in grade school. Her name was Anna, and I tried to be friends with her for obvious reasons because she had a similar name to mine. And I tried to cheer my Barbie doll with her, and she started beating me with it. But I knew.
You make it sound like that's a bad thing.
Yeah, exactly. But I knew that there was just I knew about autism back then, and that was in the 60s.
Yeah.
We were integrated. It was in Michigan when they mainstreamed very quickly in the 60s.
There was some work in California that tried to tease that out. Like, what's the prevalence versus the incidence?
Right.
The prevalence is how many we're identifying, and the incidence is the actual occurrences. And in California, they're able to gather all kinds of information and data about people with disabilities becoming diagnosed. And in one of the reports back then, I think that was maybe 6 or 10 years ago, they really felt like a large part of the increase was related to us better identifying kids that had either not been identified at all with anything or had been categorized in a different category, often maybe categorized in three other categories. So they have ADHD and oppositional behavior and social deficits. And really, they could have been characterized as having autism. But they did leave some room to say, is there something else causing an increase? I think we just don't know.
I also want to add, you know, so in terms of what causes autism, we know there's a heavy genetic loading. But we've identified, you know, hundreds of candidate genes that seem to be associated. But, you know, again, autism is really plural. And there definitely is not one gene or one genetic disorder.
Is the plurality increasing?
I believe the numbers of
types and the way it's manifesting increasing?
I think we're working hard to what they call phenotype autism. So that's in the genetic syndromes world. That means what does this syndrome look like? And so in the genetic research, what they have found is that if we're looking for one candidate gene, we're just not finding it for autism. So there must be many that play together that end up causing autism. And because autism can present in such a different way, if we could categorize them into types, it would be much more helpful than our genetic research, because we would see that this genetic problem causes this kind of autism, mm-hmm. and this other one causes a different kind of autism. But they don't have it clarified that there are, say, 10 types or anything like that.
And they're also, in addition to genetic loading, there is an interaction with the environment or epigenetics, because we know that even in the studies done with monozygotic twins or identical twins who have identical genetic makeup, there are some studies that have shown that not both children will have autism. So although they have the same genetic makeup, one may have autism and the other one may not.
I wanted to advertise a research project that Children's is a part of. So there are 25 sites across the country gathering genetic samples from families, but they're doing it just through saliva swabs, which makes it much easier. And they're doing it for as much of the family as they can. It's called the SPARK Project. SPARK.
Okay.
And the goal is to have 500 or 50,000 participants. I think we're at 10,000 right now. So
to start to see if there's a family tree of this.
Right. To just get new genetic information to, that's better clarified and to keep working along the lines of that genetic research that people have been doing to keep looking for what those identifiable problems really are.
Are people typically willing to do this?
I think when it's a saliva swab, it's so much easier because it's not a blood draw. A blood draw makes it really very difficult. You just have a Q-tip and you just swab your mouth and that's all that's really needed.
I would also add, you know, as much as we struggle with recruitment for research and studies, families of individuals with autism have always been very generous and willing to participate in studies and science to understand, advance our understanding and knowledge of it. I think as a group, they've been very collaborative and generous with their time.
Dr. Mark Tase, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
He's a director of the Ohio State University Neisonger Center and also Dr. Jackie Wynn, director for the Center for Autism Spectrum Disorder at Nationwide Children's Hospital. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dr. Emilio Amigo, clinical psychologist and director of Amigo Family Counseling. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks. That was fun.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.